I'll start, and I'm going to start with a little quiz because you have been going to sessions and you haven't had enough quizzes. Raise your hand every time something is true for you, even if it's a contradiction of the previous thing that you raised your hand for. So I keep all my communication devices on all the time so I don't miss anything. I turn my communication devices off, and I don't care if I miss calls, emails, and so forth. The way I currently use computer and communications technologies improves my quality of life. The way I use computer and communications technologies compromises my quality of life. Technology sets me free. Technology enslaves me. Welcome to Information Overload. We're very happy to have you with us today. So for most of us, all of these things are true. We're trying to stay on top of things in a very noisy world, and increasingly, a lot of us are feeling a yearning to get to the bottom of things. And in this conversation today, we'll be talking a little bit about how you do get to the bottom of things in an increasingly noisy world. So I'd like to start by introducing Bill. We're going to be having a conversation. So this isn't a 20 minutes of him, 20 minutes of me. It's we've come up with several different areas that we both want to talk about, from historical perspectives to notions of productivity and attention to solutions and the future. And we'll take turns addressing each of these areas. So Bill, start with
Q&A.
And
yeah.
Then Q&A, yeah. Yes.
So thank you, Linda. I'm delighted to be sharing this table with this amazingly esteemed expert on this particular topic. Linda, I've been reading about Linda for many years and cite her work in my book, Hamlet's Blackberry, which came out last year as an attempt to solve this problem, a sort of a philosophical attempt. But I drew on the very best research out there in addition to the philosophy of the past, and Linda was at the top of the list. So thank you all for coming. I wanted to come up with a story to encapsulate this challenge that we're talking about of information overload and why it matters. And I have a bunch of stories in my book, but better than those stories, which have been out now for a year, I had something just happen at the hot dog stand here that sort of encapsulated the whole challenge. I was waiting at lunch for my hot dog, and an older man was in front of me, just kind of standing there like me, waiting in the long line. And his wife came and joined him. And she said to him, basically, "What have you been doing?" And he said, "I just was at that Iraq panel. And they had all these experts who..." And then he pulled out his phone and he burrowed into it and he started doing something on the phone and he didn't finish the sentence. And rather than being offended, his wife pulled out her phone. And she went away.
So they're still married?
I think so. They seem like they've been married a long time, actually, and based on visual inspection. And the amazing thing was that they didn't get to the answer to what was really a kind of a significant question. I mean, on the level of those two people, what they're getting out of this festival, and also the biggest problem we have to face in the world, they drifted away into this other place, using a tool that we all know is incredibly valuable and that does bring us oodles and oodles of information and benefits and stuff every day. But my feeling, going back about 4 or 5 years ago when I started thinking about doing a book about this, is that we are not using these tools intelligently. And that story kind of encapsulates the problem. We're using them to be absent from where we are here and now, and also from the questions that we should be answering, and also from the best resources we have in here to answer them. Because when we go away to that distracted place, we're actually not drawing on our very best resources to solve problems and to be creative and to innovate. So I have a background as a media critic, and I spent most of my career, the early years of my career, critiquing the content of media. But as the digital age sort of ripened, I began to realize that, as Marshall McLuhan predicted, it was really the medium itself, the devices, that were causing us the challenge. So I sort of switched gears and did this book in which I take on this challenge, not by looking at the present so much or trying to predict the future, but by going into the past. In Hamlet's Blackberry, I was aware going into this book that we'd been through this before in some ways, that mankind is always going through this cycle with their new tools, where they bring all kinds of benefits, as we're experiencing now, but also come with downsides. And I knew people had solved this problem before. So I go back in the book into the past, I look at seven moments when some new technology came along that really presented this same conundrum, the upside and the downside. And believe it or not, people in ancient Rome often felt as overburdened and pulled in too many directions as we feel today. It's all relative. If you are born into a world in which written language is not such a big deal or is just emerging, and by the time you grow up, written language is everywhere, all around you, and you can't keep up anymore, which is what happened with many Romans, you feel overwhelmed by it, and you're having a hard time managing your attention. So there are a bunch of examples in the book. I don't have time to share them, but just to give you a few quick ones. So in ancient Rome, in each of these moments, I look at one thinker who can help us with practical ideas to solve this problem today. So in ancient Rome, I look at the great philosopher Seneca, who was arguably the busiest man on the planet at the time that he was also philosophizing, because for 6 years he was running the empire under Nero, when Nero was just a boy. And Seneca talked about people of his time suffering from what he called the restless energy of a hunted mind. And I've used that in my previous panels here. Sorry if you've heard it before. I love that phrase because it's really how I've been feeling for many years now, since sort of the early part of the last decade. That restless energy of checking, 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 and the hunted mind feeling of my inbox and my Twitter followers and all these people sort of chasing me. In a good way, often I love my Twitter followers. I'm actually a big fan of Twitter. But there's a way.
And what's your Twitter handle if people want to follow
it's
you?
It's at HamletsBB, like Hamlet's Blackberry with no apostrophe.
There you go.
Please follow me. I'd love it. So Seneca developed strategies for focus, and for focus even in the middle of the busy crowd of Rome. The ability to kind of choose one topic, one person, and hone in on that person, and basically turn whatever space you're into a quiet space, into a quiet room where you have that focus. And in a philosophical way, I think that's something we can learn from today. He's very articulate about that. The title of the book, Hamlet's Blackberry, comes from Shakespeare's age, when people were struggling not with written language, which had sort of been solved, written language itself, but with print. The deluge of print was causing overload in the Renaissance. And in Shakespeare's time, there was really this issue of the distracted mind and the inability to clean up that clutter. And Hamlet talks about that in the play Hamlet, which is one half of why the title is called Hamlet's Blackberry. The other half is that there was a device that was basically the Blackberry of that age that people were obsessed with. You used a metal stylus to write on an erasable tablet. It really was the iPad or the Blackberry of that time, and I get into that in that chapter. My third example is the 19th century, when, believe it or not, the telegraph was pulling people away from their family life. Inability to pay attention to spouse and children because business people were constantly being called off to attend to telegraph messages, complaining and feeling badly in exactly the same ways we do today about this issue. And again, in that chapter, I look at some solutions that were helpful, which I'll talk about later. Linda is the expert. Having told you about the past a little bit, Linda is the expert on how this all comes to fruition today and the version of this that we're facing today. So if I could toss over
Thank
to you.
Thank you. Sure. Thanks. So how many of you think that what you're doing is just simple multitasking when you're on all your stuff? Oh, you're not raising your hands anymore. You're done with that. Okay. All right, fine. I can live with that. We describe everything as multitasking. And the truth of the matter is, you're multitasking when you're eating a sandwich and doing your work. You're multitasking when one of the things you're doing requires cognition and the other thing is automatic. That's called simple multitasking. But we talk about everything as multitasking. So in 1997, I coined a phrase, some of you may have heard it, continuous partial attention. And continuous partial attention is complex multitasking. Because people weren't differentiating, I thought, new name, opportunity. So continuous partial attention, or complex multitasking, is when you're doing more than one thing that requires cognition, and you think you're doing them at the same time, but you're actually rapidly doing them serially. So, perfect example, driving a car, talking on a cell phone, and applying makeup. Hello. Like, that's complex multitasking. That's continuous partial attention. Or working on a cell phone on Words with Friends or something that's taking mental energy and talking on the phone. to someone else. And most of us, when we talk about multitasking today, we are not doing simple multitasking. We are using continuous partial attention. And the reason that it's important to understand the difference between the two is because if you're using simple multitasking, you're eating a sandwich and working at your desk, it doesn't affect you physiologically in the same way that continuous partial attention or complex multitasking does. So what happens when you're doing complex multitasking or using continuous partial attention? You are in a more amped up space because your motivation is, I don't want to miss anything. And that's the beginning of what neuroscientists call an upregulated sympathetic state. The sympathetic response is the fight or flight response. And, you know, since you're done raising your hands for me, I won't ask you to this time, but just think, how many of you, when you're trying to answer emails, trying to pay attention to someone, start feeling that shift in heart rate or that shift and that breathlessness and that very busy mind of, oh my gosh, and after I do this, I have to do these three other things. You're in this amped up sympathetic state. And once you're in that state, you become neurochemically habituated to keeping that state going. And certain things happen to you physiologically. Your liver dumps glucose and cholesterol. Your cortisol levels go way up. You're preparing to run from a tiger. Even if that tiger is 25 emails, it's the same physiological response. And so what else happens? Your nitric oxide balance is thrown off. Nitric oxide is implicated in inflammation, cancer, depression, diabetes, difficulty sleeping. This is all because you're sympathetic upregulated and you're starting to have this fight or flight response. And because most of us don't give ourselves real breaks from this, we end up in a state where we're chronically sympathetically upregulated. And it turns out that it isn't a matter of just saying to yourself, I need to slow down, or I need to stop, or I need to put the phone away. And I am going to venture a question again. How many of you have tried to just put the phone away and then you find yourselves pulling it out again? And it's because it's a physiological, neurochemical response. And so during the course of today, I'll be talking more about how you might address that aspect of what's going on. The second thing that's happening to you when you're in this state, when you're at either a smartphone, this is our timer, by the way, when you're at either a smartphone or you're at a laptop, typically you have poor posture, your arms are forward, your chest is caved in, you're not breathing, and I decided to give this a name too. So I call this email apnea or screen apnea, and it's about what my friend Stuart calls the primal screens in our lives. So with email apnea, you're further amping up this fight or flight state. You're further amping up this neurochemical response, and you are in a place where your autonomic nervous system is dysregulated, and the way to shift it is to address the physiology. It's not just telling yourself to stop. It's not just a mental thing. It turns out that researchers in January came out with a study that said that even 2 hours of exercise did not antidote 4 hours at a screen during the course of a day. So even if you did 2 hours of exercise, you're not going to be able to fix this. 35% of us never take a break during the day. We used to have to stand up when we used a typewriter and drop a paper somewhere or walk it somewhere. You don't have to walk anywhere anymore. It can all just fax from the computer. Everything happens from the computer. So that's sort of my situation analysis. I'm going to hand it off to Bill to start the conversation on productivity.
Great. So as Linda suggested, this is all rooted in basically how we're designed as human beings. We are really designed to connect. Our brains give us these rewards for connecting, and the more we keep connecting, the more we keep checking, the more we get this confirmation. One scientist has called it a dopamine squirt. We get this reward for checking those tweets, for checking those messages, and we keep reinforcing the problem. So yes, we're wired to connect, but does that mean we should be behaving that way? Does that mean we should be living that way? The problem, as I describe it in my book, after talking about Linda's research and related research, is that we have layered on top of that evolutionary heritage effectively a philosophy, which is everywhere in our culture, which says the more you connect, the better. I call it digital maximalism. So what it basically does is it takes the way we're wired and it says, this is also the best way to live. Philosophically, this is really taking us to the good place. And you can see this in every ad for digital technology that you see on television and on your screens. It's basically the more the better, 24/7, you cannot be more connected. And you know what? It is just not true. Even though we all know we're getting fabulous benefits, as I said earlier, from these devices. And you can't even enumerate how much good information, how many good connections to other people you're making. But at the same time, we are paying a really, really high cost. And Linda is the great expert on that cost.
So, thank you.
You're welcome.
You're awfully kind. Okay. You must get time away from the computer now. So, we've been operating as if an always-on orientation makes us better. And we've also been operating as if productivity is synonymous with man as machine, faster, more efficient. So my question to you is, what if this is not true? I mean, that's really what we're basing our behavior around today. But what if it's not true? What if everything would be better if you didn't answer the email? What if productivity isn't man as machine? What if productivity is humans being the best humans ever? And there's new research out that talks about this productivity, man as machine, mass production orientation, which, by the way, futurists in the era of mass production said, we are moving toward a four-hour workday. And one guy has figured that out. Tim Ferriss, who wrote The 4-Hour Workweek, one person has figured that out. So what if productivity is humans as better humans? So one of the things that the National Leadership Council tells us is that engaged employees actually contribute more to the bottom line. So do you want your employees going more, faster, more efficiently, or do you want your employees in a state of engagement, both with your customers, with each other, and with the work that they're doing? Corporate Leadership Council says high engagement companies demonstrate results that over-index on the S&P 500 two times revenue growth, and only 33% of employees today petitioned say that they are engaged. So one example of this, the canonical example, is Zappos shoes. And if you've read the book Delivering Happiness, or if you've met Tony Hsieh or Jen Lim, who talk about the work there at Zappos, when they first started their customer support phone line, instead of starting it and using the same metrics that other organizations used for customer support, and we've all been on the other side of that, how fast can they get through a call? How many calls can they do in an hour? Zappos took a very different approach. And what they said to employees was, solve the problem. Engage with the customer and solve the problem. And what they found is they don't have burnout. They have very loyal customers. I've called them and, you know, trying to figure out sizes. I never feel any risk in ordering anything I want and returning it. So they're finding that not only does it contribute to their bottom line, but phone support, which normally has huge retention issues, they have people who love being in phone support at Zappos. So this is an example of this kind of orientation. When Amazon bought Zappos, they didn't say, now do things our way. They said, keep doing things your way. It's really working. So at the heart of this is something I want to connect the dots on. You guys are all going to sessions on the economy, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate that you came here instead of to David Rubenstein, who's also speaking right now. But I'm gonna talk to you about this very interesting set of connections and dots. So here we are over here in this state of continuous partial attention, trying to answer every email, trying to stay on top of everything. And what happens in this state is that we become stressed, vigilant, and it turns out when your sympathetic nervous system is upregulated, you are also resistant to change, impulsive, and you have poor judgment. Anybody ever gotten a flame email? Wonder why? I mean, this is the kind of thing that's happening. Now, it also turns out Recently, I've been studying all of this research on luck and what makes us lucky. And it turns out that it isn't just a matter of some people are and some people aren't. There's a personality trait associated with luckiness. And this is according to Dr. Richard Wiseman's research. And that personality trait is openness. So I'll give you an example of one of Dr. Wiseman's studies. He took two groups, and he asked people to divide themselves between self-described lucky, self-described unlucky. So both of these groups had to go through a newspaper, and they had to find how many photographs, count how many photographs were in that newspaper. The people who described themselves as unlucky took several minutes to do the exercise. The people who described themselves as lucky took only a few seconds to do the exercise. The reason for that was that on the second page of the newspaper, half a page, 2-inch high type, it said, "Stop counting. There are 43 photographs in this newspaper." But the unlucky people had continuous partial attention and had barely broken away from their technology to come do this survey, while the lucky people were there, present, open, and picking up what was in their environment. If we expect to be innovative in our companies, and if we want to be lucky in our personal lives, then we have an opportunity to start operating in a way where we move toward engagement and we move toward a more balanced autonomic state. So there's another piece of this, which is something called inattentional blindness. And this also happens when we're in this state of continuous partial attention. Inattentional blindness, many of you may have seen the gorilla video. Is that familiar? So I'll describe it very quickly. You're asked, as you're shown this video, how many times do the players in white pass the ball? And then after the players in white pass the ball, you think, gee, I got it. It's like 14. And you see a screen saying, 14 passes? That's right. Next screen says, but did you see the gorilla? And then they rewind the video. And because people are so focused on counting the number of times the ball is being passed, they miss that a large black gorilla walks across the stage, beats its chest, and then walks off. So what happens to us in this stressed, vigilant, I gotta stay on top of everything state is that we miss the things that are right in front of us that in fact may have the most important clues, the most important information for what we really would benefit from doing next. I'm going to pass this off to Bill now, who's going to start the conversation on solutions.
So basically, Linda's given us all these great insights on actually what's happening when we are overconnected, when we're suffering from overload. But the question is, what do we do about it? How do you take all this information into your own life, into your own time management and so forth during the day and really get to a different place and live differently and work differently and be more productive? So what I do in the book, the subtitle of my book is A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. And what I do in the book is I just take all those lessons I gleaned from all those smart people in the past at those 7 moments, and I turn them into ideas for today, solutions for today. But really, all the solutions come down to one essential idea, which I call opening up gaps between yourself and your screen life. We have to open up some gaps so we get to that place where we're less vigilant, where we can be lucky in the way that Linda described it, where we are present and open to things that are coming at us, that are happening around us, that are not just in the inbox, because the inbox is not necessarily the best place, as we've seen, to see those opportunities. So I give my thesis on how we're going to solve this problem is that we have to begin not in a big macro way talking about how we can solve this as a civilization, but in a very personal way, rooted in our own lives, because I think that's where all the best change happens. So I give a couple examples of things that I've done in my life and really that my family has done, very personal examples that I think can be expanded and applied beyond the one person. And I'll just give you an example, and they're both two examples. They're both examples of gaps. So one is that when my wife and I realized 4 years ago that we were losing all this valuable family connectedness of the best sort because we were being pulled away from each other by our screens and really not being together anymore, we were in a sense being over-vigilant, monitoring the world beyond the house rather than each other and getting all those wonderful benefits you get from your relationships, we started a simple ritual. We call it the Internet Sabbath, and I have talked about this in other panels as well, so if it's a repeat, I'm sorry. We unplug the modem, the household modem that serves all our computers on Friday night, and it stays unplugged till Monday morning. We are offline weekends. Now, I should caution that we're both writers. We can do this. Not everybody could do this. Not every job would allow people to have this particular ritual. But two lessons have come out of the Internet Sabbath for my family. We've been at it for 4 years. We're still doing it. One is that if you try something like this, if you open up gaps like this somewhere in your life on a regular basis, you can revolutionize your life and solve this problem that Linda has been talking about. By being offline those 2 days a week, we find we are not just better people on the weekends and more aware of each other and doing better thinking and better connecting. We're better during the week. We're better connectors, better digital people. When I come back to Twitter on Monday morning, I'm a better Twitter person because I've had some time away, because I've opened up that gap. Another example of gaps we can open up that I talk about in the book is, that's a gap of time, obviously, is gaps in space, defining spaces as disconnected zones, or what I call Walden zones, inspired by Henry David Thoreau's decision to spend 2 years in that cabin at Walden Pond. We can open up Walden zones in our own homes, rooms that are disconnected, that are set aside as special, a place that's kind of sacred, where you're going to have a kind of connection that's not about the screen, where you can move out of this state that Linda has described so well and into this other state. Companies are beginning to have zones like this, forward-thinking companies, because this is where creativity in the digital age can happen, where you can take all those benefits you get from the screen and do something unique with them, do something new using your own creativity. Now, as I said, this all happens in my life on the personal level, but in the business world, there are versions of it. And again, Linda's the expert on that.
So I'm going to talk about both the business world and the personal world. And I have some credibility here. I was in high tech for 20 years at both Apple and Microsoft, and worked for both John Sculley and Steve Ballmer. And I've lived a life of getting 1,000 emails a day, and I have had the experience of my mother saying, your tombstone is not going to say returned every email. It's going to say loving daughter of. So so get it together. I'm going to start with this. I thought it would say returned every email, actually. I'm going to start with a story, and I told part of this story the other day in a panel with Sherry Turkle. I'll give the rest of it today. A couple weeks ago, I was visiting a friend in the Bay Area, and she has an adorable 4-year-old son named Theo, and she was working on the computer, and Theo was playing, and Theo started muttering, and then he looked at her, and he said, you know, I would rather be a zombie weasel than an adult, because you adults are always on phones and computers, and you're always saying, just a moment. And she said, just a moment. I'm going to finish what I'm doing. And then, so when she finished, and she got over to Theo, Theo looked at her, and he said, just a moment. So one of the things that we're doing is we are modeling behavior for our children. And in modeling that behavior, we need to be aware of what message we're giving them. Sherry Turkle talked about this. I talk about this. What's happening at your dinner table? Is that a place where technology is banned? I was at a Passover Seder last year, and the teenagers all had their BlackBerries going under the table, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, there's really no limit here. So I talked a little bit about the nervous system and what you can do to re-regulate your dysregulated nervous system. And so the first thing is something I'm going to teach you, and if you want to follow along, please feel free. It's a breathing technique that shifts your nervous system to a more parasympathetic or rest and renew state, really easy. It's an inhale and exhale only through the nose, with the exhale twice as long as the inhale. So if you want to do this, inhale to the count of 4 through the nose, exhale slowly to the count of 6 or 8, wherever you can go at high altitude. And then do it again. And you can be doing this as I'm talking to you, and you'll find that it does contribute to a shift in your nervous system. I don't have time to go into his work today, but there's a neuroscientist named Stephen Porges who's written a book called Polyvagal Theory, and he also talks about ways to re-regulate your nervous system. Yoga and meditation are popular today in part because they contribute to helping re-regulate a dysregulated nervous system. Nature, going out into nature, just giving yourself some moments in green. And if you haven't read Richard Louv's latest book, The Nature Principle, I couldn't recommend it more highly. It's a wonderful read. It refers to plenty of research on exactly what happens to our bodies and our minds when we're in nature. And you can probably feel some of the benefit of that here in Aspen. It's so beautiful. I have written about and I talk about, it's not the what, the technology, it's the how. How am I using it? And one of the things that I've done in the last 2 years, 3 years, is I've interviewed musicians. Because when musicians first start playing an instrument, they're completely consumed by the instrument. They don't know how to breathe. They don't know how to stand. And you see the same thing happening to them that you see on people at a computer. They're in this very stressed state. As they become more experienced as musicians, they play oppositionally with the instrument. They stay embodied, and the instrument is on its own. So in the email apnea studies that I've done, and here's how that works. I'm not in an institution. If you come to my home to visit or for dinner, I have a heart rate variability ear clip, and before we sit and relax together, you get to be part of my experimental group without me having to get an IRB. So if you visit me, heart rate variability ear clip, and then you get to do mobile phone, you get to do email. The only people who showed up as not having email apnea, and I have tested many people, are professional athletes and trained musicians and dancers. And that's what caused me to go study what is it that musicians were doing, what is it that athletes were doing that was different. They have learned how to breathe for performance sports or for performance music. And in learning that, they can switch contexts. I happen to believe that if we could have 3 10-minute periods a day in public schools for K through 6, that we'd have less bullying, we'd have much healthier kids because we'd be breathing, we'd be less impulsive, we'd be more autonomically regulated. Take vacations. 500 million vacation days go unused every year. That is annually 2 million years of lost vacation days. Wow. 92% of us check into work when we go on vacation. 92% of us don't stop even when we go on. So take a vacation, because it turns out that activity in the hippocampus and the neocortex increase during periods of wakeful rest. So if you're sitting in here having a period of wakeful rest, you're getting smarter, because those are the parts of the brain that are most closely associated with what we think of as intelligence. Organizationally, what can we do? Well, I think it's high time that we redefine productivity. It's not about man as machine. It's about humans being the best humans they can be and using machines in the ways that machines can help and support that activity. So start with redefining productivity. Start with redefining attention. Attention in the 1890s, when William James defined it, the definition used to be it's what you choose to focus on as well as what you choose not to focus on. If you look up attention in the dictionary today, it's only what you choose to focus on. Well, guess what? We have a lot of choice, and our opportunity is to say, what are the things I'm not going to do? One of the pieces that I wrote, it's up on the Huffington Post, is it time to retire the never-ending list? We never celebrate at the end of a day. All we do is add more to that list. And when you never celebrate, you never have a sense of completion, and that leads to burnout. In that particular post, I talked about a survey that I did where I asked people if they manage their time or if they manage their attention. People who said they manage their time reported much higher levels of burnout, didn't know how they were going to get everything done. People who manage their attention or who manage both their time and attention reported more states of flow, love their jobs. So is it time to retire the never-ending list? Another piece that's up on the Huffington Post is, it isn't the what, it's the how. Am I breathing while I'm sitting at the computer? I mean, one of the things that I do now, I have an M-Wave 2 from HeartMath. I put the heart rate variability ear clip on. I set the device next to me on the table. And if I see that that light is red for a long time, it means that I'm autonomically dysregulated. And there's a breathing metronome on that. And I use that as a passive, ambient, non-invasive way of cueing myself. Because when I go into this other state, I am more receptive. I have more ideas. I'm less stressed, anxious, and impulsive. So organizationally, I'll give two more quick examples. One example happened for me a couple of years ago. I was giving a talk to McDonald's executives, and at that time, Mike Roberts was the COO of McDonald's, and he was running this meeting. It was their top global marketing execs from around the world, and he had four of us present. And after every presentation, he looked at everybody and he said, "Now take 5 minutes, sit quietly, please don't get up. You can close your eyes, you can make a few notes." He would take off, then he'd introduce the next speaker. People had 5 minutes. At the end of the day, we had a meeting. There were over 30 of us sitting in this meeting. It was the most productive, functional brainstorming meeting that I've ever been in. People had ideas. People synced up easily. They came out with premium coffee within 8 months of that meeting. It was a topic of discussion. So they got so much more out of not pushing to have every minute be so full. The last example I want to give is an example from Genentech. Genentech, the senior vice president of IT, a fellow named Todd Pierce, linked up with a woman from a company called An Appropriate Response, Pamela Weiss, and they created a renewal program for employees. They were dealing with layoffs. They were dealing with all kinds of difficult situations at the company. And IT is a very stressful place to be. You're trying to meet everybody's needs. So they developed a program called the Personal Excellence Program, and there's a lot more information on this online. The result of this program was that 99% of the people who went through this program reported higher levels of engagement and higher levels of being able to self-correct on the job. One of the elements of the program is something that they call a three-center check-in, and they do this before they start meetings in the IT department. So the three-center check-in, very briefly, it's usually about 3 or 4 minutes, and you take your time for it, is, you know, everybody stop, take a minute, what are you thinking? And don't judge it, just let it go, take a minute to just be aware. Drop down to the heart center, what are you feeling? What are the emotions that you're feeling? What's going on? Drop down to the belly. What are you feeling? What are the sensations in your body? They would do this just at the beginning of a meeting for a couple of minutes. People were more cooperative and collaborative during the meetings. Even the people who weren't trained in the program, because they were so much calmer in their approach to everybody and everything, the feeling and the way of relating started to spread across the organization. So there are so many things that we can do on both an individual level and as companies. And I'm happy to talk more with anyone on any of these things. So I'm going to make one comment about the future and then hand it off to Bill, who's going to wrap up. In terms of the future, I am an optimist. I think that the kids today who are experiencing our generation's over-dependence and sort of compulsion around technology, they are not going to want devices at the table. They are going to be wanting to relate to their children, and they're going to start building based on what they would have preferred. Instead of just a moment, they're going to be, you know, yes, what do you need? What do you want? I think millennials want to figure this out, and they want us to figure it out. They want quality of life. And for those of you who are in companies, one of the things that you hear from millennials is, tell me what you want me to do. I am leaving at 6 p.m. Have you heard that from the millennials who work for you? I will be leaving at this time. I'm going to have a life outside of work. And Bill, wrap up.
Yeah, and on that note, you learn a lot about your own book when you write a book after it comes out, and you see the reception that it gets, and you realize that there were things happening out there in the world that you were maybe tapping into without even realizing it. And this connects to what Linda just said and optimism about the future. One of the things that I've learned in the last year traveling around talking about my message of basically having a philosophy of balance rather than the more connected you are, the better, is that something is happening out there in the culture, particularly among young people, that I think is analogous to what was happening in the late 1950s when books were being read with titles like The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, and this feeling that people were being conformists and basically losing their freedom, losing their creativity because they were basically paying too much attention to the man, as it was called back then. And there's some rising awareness today, both out in the world generally and in organizations, that this is happening to people. The favorite headline of any piece that's been written about my book in the last year, and there's been an awful lot of pieces, is the gadget in the gray flannel suit. People are beginning to realize that these gadgets are tools not just of all these physiological and mental effects that we're feeling, but of conformity and of groupthink. You know, we've been told for a long time that we need to obey the wisdom of the crowd. That's where the future is. That's where all the intelligence is. A new study is just out from the National Academy of Sciences, which shows that the wisdom of the crowd, the collective wisdom effect, goes down dramatically when the members of the crowd who are expressing their views on something are exposed to social influence of other people. So in other words, if you spend all day immersed in the crowd and everybody in the crowd is living that way, and reflecting off each other and trying to monitor what everybody else is thinking, the crowd itself becomes stupider and doesn't have as much to offer the world. Now, that is a very important revelation when you think about it, because that's completely contrary to what we've been led to believe for the last X number of years. The other reason I think to be optimistic is that I'm seeing, and Linda's given a couple examples of this already, but in my travels, I'm seeing organizations really being creative and innovative and really deciding to buck the tide in the culture and to question this assumption that's been out there. I was walking over to this session today, and I saw one of those banners that's waving in the wind on the walkway. It said, "Freedom lies in being bold, Robert Frost." And there are a lot of bold organizations that are trying new things. In my book, I write about some of the leaders in terms of workplace experiments doing the kinds of things Linda also talked about. One of them is Intel, the very company that brought us this revolution with its chips. Has been working on experiments in its own workplace for many years now in terms of giving people these kinds of gaps, these kinds of spaces where they can do this different kind of thinking, this different kind of away from the madness space so that they can go to that place of innovation where all the good stuff comes from. And they have found, those studies have revealed that rituals and practices that have positive names and positive goals, like the most successful one at Intel was a regular weekly ritual called Quiet Time. Because it had that positive name as opposed to something like No Email Fridays, which sounds very negative.
Which didn't work at all, by the way.
It didn't work at all. Quiet time worked for Intel, and they kept it in place and continued to work with that. It's all about remembering the individual employee is the beginning of this change, and that's where the change is going to happen. The other thing that's happening that is really, really fascinating is technology companies are actually looking at the technology itself that has brought us this problem, the ways that it can be changed to give us more control. So imagine if you could customize the way the internet comes to you through your phone, through your modem in your house, so that, for example, it goes on and off automatically at different times of the day, like setting a thermostat, like we do for the heat and the air conditioning, where you're basically deciding, I'm going to be connected these times of day, not connected these times of day, and it's automatic. So you don't have to do what I do every Friday night, which is go reach way behind my desk and do this unwieldy thing of pulling the plug. It's just part of your life. It's on and off, it's in and out, it's connect and disconnect, because that's where all the good stuff comes from. I think that the basic message is that I really believe that the next tech revolution is going to be philosophical. We're going to change how we think about these devices and solve all these problems that we've been talking about up here today, and I think that's going to take this digital revolution to the next level where it needs to go. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. And with that, I think we could
take
some questions.
We'll take
questions. So thank you for
listening. We'll talk about anything. Yes, yeah. Alan?
My question is kind of combining personalized medicine in this. A few years ago, I had the 23andMe test, and they keep updating it. And I found it interesting when it came back saying I was a very high caffeine metabolizer. I'm kind of curious about this type of thing, since there's a physiological reaction, if some people are more or less affected. Perhaps their family is going to be more affected, but if they're more or less affected. And also, in the interest of truth and honesty, I am, you know, one of those people that acts like that in daily life. And is there also a connection to addiction? Because you get kind of an endorphin-like high or a habituation of just feeling like that on a daily basis. So I'm wondering if any of your research goes to those areas.
So I'm also on 23andMe. I am a very poor caffeine metabolizer. And here's what that means, because I've checked it out. You are physiologically more able to detoxify stress than I am. Unless you get that tested, you don't know what kind of metabolizer you are. But the fact that you can rapidly detoxify, which is, you know, you're talking about a rapid phase one liver detoxification, rapid phase two liver detoxification, I happen to be slow in that range. So it's a good thing to know about yourself. If you know that about yourself, you can take additional steps. In talking about addiction, there is, yes, a neurochemical habituation. Sherry Turkle, who's in the audience here, talks about how the language of addiction can be problematic because often it implies having to give something up, which we're not going to be doing with technology. At the same time, there's research out of the University of Portugal that says that we become neurochemically habituated and it causes us to perseverate on a behavior that we may not want to perseverate on, which is why taking steps physiologically to re-regulate your nervous system, go out in nature, breathe with an exhale twice as long as the inhale, read Stephen Porges on polyvagal theory to learn other exercises that involve very subtle head or eye movements that will re-regulate your nervous system.
If I could say something,
sure.
Too. This came up in my solo salon talk last night, the question of not so much biological but psychological, the question of people who have extrovert personalities and people who have introvert personalities. And I think, and there's a whole spectrum, of course, and I think that is a real factor here. I think we just had, this is something that 23andMe probably couldn't pick up, but it really matters. You know, we have different tendencies, we have different needs on the psychological, emotional level, and I think that really plays into the extent to which we can really get hooked on this and not be able to pull away. I meet people all the time who say, I met a guy at my salon last night, he came, and he seemed to enjoy it, but he said to me afterwards, you know, it's weird. I do not feel this at all, this stuff everybody in the room was talking about. I never feel addicted to my devices. They seem to be telling the truth.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Is there a difference between the between men and women in the susceptibility to be computer ridden? And I watch women do three things at once, and I am astounded. I know a man can't do these. So I would think that because they can, I'm serious. A woman can do three things, be talking on the telephone, typing down here, and doing something else. And a man can't do that. And I'm thinking maybe there is because they are so concentrated three times as much, there's probably more of a susceptibility to your studies. Do you find that at all?
I haven't seen studies that divide by gender. I have seen studies that look at both complex and simple multitasking. And the truth that comes out, or I believe it as a truth, that comes out in the studies is that we believe we're doing fine when we're doing all of these things at once, so to speak. We're actually doing them serially and very rapidly. We believe that we're doing fine, but we're actually responding less well to tasks. When they give people tasks that require cognition or judgment, people respond much more poorly on all those tasks. And they talk about a drop of 10 IQ points in what you're doing. So you may look at someone and say, hey, you look like you're doing better than I am. Not so fast. I'm not sure.
Also, I think it is, as Linda suggests, it is generally really demonstrated pretty conclusively by the research that multitasking is a myth and that we can't effectively multitask. But there is a University of California study which showed that there are 2% of people who are so-called super taskers who actually really can do this better than the rest of us. But that study, I'm pretty sure I remember it correctly, it did not show any breakdown by gender. It was
but
just
maybe the woman
people.
That you're watching is one of those people. Any other questions?
That's the wrong women.
Yes, yes.
Two questions for you. The first question is, please give advice on how to deal with the smartphone thing, because we work off of our BlackBerries, and it's got our Twitter, it's got our Facebook, it's texting, it's people calling on cell phones. I mean, how can you turn that off and get away from that? And then the second question relates to this proliferation, if you will, of people with children and people with ADD and ADHD. Thoughts about those two things?
On the first one, you know, I'm amazed that they're called smartphones because I think they are dumb phones. I really do. And this notion that we want everything all the time and basically can't customize how the information is coming on those smartphones, and we can't, you know, it makes it kind of hard to choose one of the many things the smartphone does and have that be the focus of what it's doing. I think this is why the iPad is so wonderful, because it really is less naturally multitasking tool. You know, it basically takes you to a more focused place because of the way it's designed.
Well, guess what? We don't have email apnea using an iPad.
Yeah.
Hello.
Exactly.
Because you're in a different physical relationship to the device.
And so, you're using your hands, I think, in a more natural way.
But you're
a more
breathing.
Way.
You're more likely to be breathing when you're using an iPad.
Yeah. So,
well, sometimes.
You know, I personally think that actually the smartphone, if it really is going to be a smartphone, has to become a lot more sophisticated. I think these phones are incredibly primitive in the way they're delivering internet to us. And right now, we're basically stuck with developing our own rituals and using basically a life approach, like we've been talking about, a work-life balance idea, and also an intra-work balance. I'm not getting my work done here in the cubicle well because my smartphone is leading me around on a leash. I'm going to pay more attention to how that's happening. Right now, that's basically the answer.
So another piece of that is pay attention to the physiology. Am I breathing? Ask yourself, what do I want to be doing right now? What am I feeling? Someone came up to me after I gave a talk on email apnea at a conference, and they said, Linda, how do I know when to take a break from my computer? And I said, ask yourself how you're feeling.
Yes.
And the person looked at me and said, I don't know how I'm feeling. And I looked at them and said, take a break now. So it's really important to say, how am I feeling? What is it I really want to be doing right now? And sometimes I might be with someone else and I'll say, I'm sending a text to the person who's joining us for dinner, and then I'm putting the phone away. Or when I get to a meal with someone, I turn it off. I take it out of view. So it requires a certain amount of intentionality, and you know what? The breathing, for me, the M-Wave 2, where I have a little device that if I can't figure out if I'm autonomically regulated, guess what? The technology knows if I'm autonomically regulated. That helps.
I do. You know what I do? I call it just the hamster test. If I start to see the hamster in the wheel inside my head, and he's going faster and faster, I know it's time. You know, I am living like a hamster in a wheel, and that it sounds very basic, but it works as well for me as I think any right. functional MRI would ever work.
Yeah. You know? And go outside. Go outside. Yes, sir.
Linda, have you been aware of anybody else doing research on what I'll call the quality of decision making? Because we've talked in other conversations this week about one of the consequences of all this hookup is speed.
Mm-hmm.
and the expectation that people ask shorter questions to get faster answers. In the corporate world that I exist in, and you, a lot of the key decisions can't be made quickly. Has there been anyone trying to say, if you are not doing the kinds of things that both you and Bill were talking about, there are decision-making consequences that we can document both negatively and, if we are doing them, positively?
Yes, there are people who are starting to do some of that research. Antonio Damasio, who was here last year, he did a study that, you know, when the press first came out on it, the title was, Does Twitter Make Us Immoral? And then later it was sort of dialed back. Does social media give us poor judgment? But the bottom line is, when we're dealing with any kind of rapid-fire media, his conclusions were that we became more impulsive and our judgment was compromised. And there are others who are starting to do studies like that. When I was doing my studies on email apnea, just to say, hey, what's happening and is there really an effect here that's happening, the next step for me was to go look at all the research in what happens when we cumulatively shallow breathe or breath hold. And if you've read the studies on sleep apnea, which I spent some time with some of the psych and neuroscience people at University of Chicago, you know, you definitely have poor judgment, IQ goes down, all kinds of things happen as a result of this. In this fight or flight state, we become more impulsive. There's a lot of research. Who wrote the book about zebras? The guy at Stanford. Why zebras don't take why zebras don't get ulcers. His work is phenomenal. He talks about the stress response. He doesn't tie it to email apnea. I've been, you know, one of the voices that said, hey, what's happening at these machines is that we're not breathing. We're in this upregulated fight or flight state. Well, then you drop over to his work, you drop over to some of the other researchers who have looked at what are the results from not breathing or from this chronic fight or flight state, and you see all the answers are right there.
I would also point to a lot of, I see it all the time, if you begin to look for this, a lot of cultural evidence in the media of people, frankly, getting in trouble, doing something stupid, losing their job, and then if you read deeper into the story, you find out they were one of these people who were, you know, supposedly a master of social media, and Congressman Wiener is the poster boy for that idea.
Oh my gosh, you're right.
Yes, and I'm beginning to think that if you see someone being called a master of social media, watch out and check your wallet, because you don't know what's going to happen next, really.
Or what kind of pictures they're sending.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Can you help us understand a bit more what you mean by lucky people versus unlucky? It can't be that the laws of probability
yes.
are applying differentially
yes.
to people. So what's lucky?
Thank you for asking that, because I went over that very quickly because we are watching this stopwatch here and trying to keep things moving. So a lot of us think that you're either born lucky or you're not. And it actually is something that can be cultivated. And the personality trait most closely associated with luck is openness. So how do you cultivate that personality trait? Well, it turns out that...
What is luck?
What is... Oh, define luck. Ah, you have a feeling that good things happen to you. So if you go back to Richard Wiseman's work, when he talks to lucky people, they say, good things always happen for me. And in fact, in one of his studies... a self-described unlucky person, a self-described lucky person, they were both asked to go to a coffee shop, have some coffee, and then come back and report on their day. So Wiseman and his team had taped a 5-pound note to the ground near the entry of the cafe. The lucky person is going along his way, sees the 5-pound note, picks it up, walks into the cafe, sits next to someone, says, I'd love to treat you to coffee. I just found this 5-pound note. They begin a conversation. The person gives him a business opportunity to come up with. The woman who described herself as unlucky misses the 5-pound note because she's going in to get her coffee, sits next to the same person. It was an actor, but there were different actors placed around the restaurant, sits next to the same person, doesn't say a word to him, drinks her coffee, goes back and says, "Nothing happened." And the other guy is like, "Fabulous day. Found money, found a relationship, found this." Now, I would say we are unluckier when we're walking in to the cafe like this. There's no possibility of a 5-pound note. There's no possibility of a person sitting next to us with a business opportunity because that person doesn't exist. So that's what I mean. Questions? Got it. Okay, great.
It's a self-perception.
Yes.
What, Jim?
Jim Fallows?
I had an observational point and then a question.
Sure.
Having come to these Ideas Festivals since their beginning, since the Atlantic has been putting on too, I have a picture in my mind of the walkway between the Pepke, Greenwald, et cetera, area and the Aspen Meadows area. I remember in the first, 5 or 6 years ago, you'd see people walking across there, talking with each other, looking at the trees, and there's pictures I can see both in my mind. And now the majority of people you see making that walk are looking at their devices. And I think that if we go out here, most people will see are walking or holding one of their
yes.
devices. A self-regulating trick I have for myself is, to me, it looks so undignified to walk and hold a smartphone that as a point of pride, I never do that. It just seems somehow shameful. Is that correct? And I don't let you do it either. This is one. It's a version of your digital Sabbath. So my question for you, Bill, is why are you on Twitter at all? Since it seems like the extreme case.
Oh, we were going to talk about this.
Okay. I love Twitter.
Yeah, I love Twitter also.
We love Twitter.
I think
fit into the
so
the
Twitter's not the extreme version if you use it intelligently and if you follow people who are using it intelligently. So I have followed some people. I've only been on a year. But I followed some people who I thought looked promising, same sensibility, I'm going to love their tweets. And then they were these people who were, I'm eating a bag of Fritos now. And the beauty of Twitter, unlike Facebook, is the ties are not strong ties, they're weak ties, because you generally don't know the people. It's not that person you went to third grade with who found you on Facebook and you're kind of stuck with them. It's this person you can unfollow with the touch of a button. So that's
number
one.
We love that, the freedom of Twitter.
The other thing is the Twitter feed is all day, always going, never stopping. And if you basically release yourself from the obligation to see everything and just check in when you feel like it and see what's there serendipitously, serendipity's sort of gone out of style, unfortunately, but I love it. It feels really wonderful. And it's like this party I get to join when I feel like it. And I'm not in the party all day long. So I love it. I have a fantasy of going off Facebook, but my publisher made me put up this page about my book, and I have to stay on there to monitor that, but it just drives me crazy.
I won't touch Facebook, but I love my Twitter. And I love my Twitter because I follow people who are reading or tweeting things in health, science, technology, and they're my filters. And
yes.
I can use them as a filter when I don't have time to do the other scanning that I want to do. And I met Tony Schwartz. Some of you may have heard him speak here earlier. I got on Twitter, and a few months later, I was getting a message from Tony Schwartz. And I thought, I've loved his work forever. He's following me. What up? So I've found that on Twitter, it's a place where I meet people that I want to know instead of, as Bill said, being stuck with people who I was happy to have in the past. And it's been just a wonderful filter. I mean, the people I want to have from my past, I see. I call you, right? I call you, I email you, whatever. Yeah, but why do I want to be deluged with friend requests? I mean, to me, a friend is someone I have a connection with,
Do we have time for another one?
Yes.
Yeah.
You pick. I've been.
Oh, how about right here? Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. We'll talk later. Yeah, we'll talk later.
I just had a quick question. Would it be okay to get both of your Twitter addresses?
Sure. Yeah. So. I'm Linda Stone, at Linda Stone.
Oh, that's easy.
And you're
Yeah, there were like 50
Hamlet's
people who
BB.
Took William Powers when I wanted it. At Hamlet's BB.
At
like Hamlet's Blackberry. Like Hamlet's Blackberry, but it's Hamlet's BB. At sign Hamlet, H-A-M-L-E-T-S-B-B.
And I'm just Linda Stone. One more, you, yes.
I was curious at all. Have you come into any research that looks at it, the focus for everything I've listened to all week has really been on the person and focusing on the individual and how they get themselves out of this rut. But as we're in a society that is so quick for the answer and wants so desperately to multitask or supertask, as you put it, is there any fear that you guys see or any research that's out there that they're trying to change the technology to do that for us? I've heard Sir Ken Robinson call it like the Terminator syndrome. And I was wondering if you've run into any of that in your research, because to me it seems like there will be a glut of people who don't know they're suffering from what you're talking about and will do everything in their power to have that answer quicker, faster.
I know what's happening to their physiology and their nervous system, and the other guys are going to outlive them.
You mean technology that slows it down for us? Is that what you're basically saying? Oh, so like offloading. Well, I mean, that does seem to be the vision that a lot of people these days, one of the memes in our culture right now, I'm sure you've noticed, is the chip in the brain thing that everyone keeps saying we're going to have X years from now. It seems to be getting closer and closer every time someone brings it up. That strikes me as one of these things, kind of like the paperless society that was supposed to come 60 years ago that never happened. I'm a little bit dubious on the chip in the brain, but Linda might have a different view on that.
I'm equally dubious. I would want a chip in my brain if I had Parkinson's, but if not, no thanks. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.